All right, so our plan is to finish chapters 11, 12, and 13 tonight, and if you plan to be here next week, please read chapters 14 and 15. As a brief review, in our class last week, we talked briefly about two judges, Tola and Jair, and the majority of our class was spent on the character of Jephthah, whose story will conclude tonight. We talked about how Israel was yet again unfaithful to God and in distress because of their Ammonite oppressors, whom Jephthah will lead a charge against in our reading this evening to conquer. We were introduced to Jephthah, noted that his mother was a prostitute, his dad was called Gilead, and his brothers expelled him from their family because his mother wasn't the same as theirs. That then he was asked by the leaders to come back and lead the Gileadite forces against the Ammonites to defeat them, which he agreed to on the condition that he would become head over that group. So he wanted to be both leader militarily and head, which likely involved getting back his inheritance that he had been disinherited from previously. And then finally, what we spent the last part of our class last week talking about was Jephthah's attempt to speak reasonably with the Ammonite king and try and resolve their conflict peaceably, which was not achieved. And so we're going to read now about him preparing for battle, but even the battle against the Ammonites is really just a footnote in the story of Jephthah. So continuing on, tonight in concluding chapter 11, we're going to talk about the Israelites' victory over the Ammonites, and then also about Jephthah's foolish vow. So after this failed attempt at diplomacy with the king of Ammon, the Spirit of the Lord empowered Jephthah to travel to the Ammonites' territory to do battle against them. And that's the first and only time that we read in relation to Jephthah about the Spirit of the Lord or God directly commissioning him to do work. And it's important to note, especially with what he'll come to do, that the Spirit of the Lord is empowering Jephthah for their battle against the Ammonites, not to do anything else that we'll read about in the rest of this chapter, namely the foolish vow that he makes. And it's at this point, as he prepares for battle against the Ammonites, that he makes his foolish vow. In the ESV, it translates it this way: if you will give the Ammonites into my hand, then whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. Does anyone's Bible have a footnote on the word whatever there in his vow? Verse 31, how else it could be translated besides whatever? So the ESV has a footnote that it could be whoever. So the language he uses there is inclusive of people, not just whatever as in an animal, but people. So looking at a reconstruction of what an Israelite house might have looked like during the time of Jephthah, you see that they would have kept likely animals inside of their house at night. And it's possible that this is part of what Jephthah is envisioning upon his return as to what would greet him when he made his return in victory. However, again, the language does include people, and as we'll come to see, it includes his daughter. So very definitely, the vow that he's making here includes people in addition to animals. And so what we have here is Jephthah vowing an unknown item, indicating either a willingness to give up anything or anyone for victory, or as some have suggested, this is Jephthah simply taking a hasty action that had very little thought behind it. But remember what was at stake for him. If he wasn't successful in this battle and did not conquer the Ammonites, then what was at jeopardy for Jephthah? That's right. Yeah, his position and his status. And so, yes, this was certainly a stressful situation for him, but his resolve back from verse 27 when he was communicating with the Ammonite king should have been enough. When he said, "The Lord the judge decide this day between the people of Israel and the people of Ammon." Again, he's not ambiguous about what his vow involved. He promised to offer it up as a whole burnt offering. So again, the structure of homes in ancient Israel shows that they had room for stables, making it possible that an animal could have come out of Jephthah's home. And one author suggested that this vow might be an act of vengeance against his brothers. If he had come back to his family and become head over his family again, assuming that he had reassumed that position as head over a larger clan, that he hoped that one of his brother's wives or children will emerge first. So the NET translates it not as whatever, but in this way. It says in verse 30, Jephthah made a vow to the Lord, saying, if you really do hand the Ammonites over to me, then whoever is the first to come through the doors of my house to meet me, when I return safely from fighting the Ammonites, he will belong to the Lord, and I will offer him up as a burnt sacrifice. So with all this, I think it's helpful in our discussion for me to just briefly review what the Old Testament has to say about vows. So when vows were made, God expected those vows to be fulfilled in a timely manner. So those references there, Numbers 30 and verse 2, if a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. And then Deuteronomy 23, 21, if you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay fulfilling it. We haven't read this far yet, or talked about this far yet in the story, but did Jephthah follow that command in relation to vows? No, he delayed, because he allowed his daughter 2 months to go and mourn for her virginity before he fulfilled the vow. Next, human sacrifice was expressly forbidden, while animal sacrifice could acceptably accompany a vow. And God gave direction on that in the verses cited there. And then finally, in relation to a rash vow, if a rash or thoughtless vow was made, the individual who made that vow, upon realizing what they had done, could make atonement for that vow with a sin offering. That's discussed in Leviticus 5, verses 4 through 6. So my issue in reading through these verses and in the account of Jephthah, we'll have a lot of issues with it, but one of them is, I don't know for certain that Jephthah's vow was rash or thoughtless. It's a more sinister thought, but if it was premeditated and purposeful that he was willing to give up whatever or whoever, if God gave him a victory in his eyes, then that's not rash. That's not thoughtless. That's premeditated and purposeful. So again, we'll talk about that more in a moment. This brings, though, to thought, the application for us is that you and I can want something so badly that we're willing to do whatever it takes to get it. That's the position that Jephthah was in. He wanted victory so badly, it seems like he was willing to give up whatever it took to achieve that victory. And the thing that he wanted, victory over the Ammonites, in itself was not wrong. In fact, it was what God wanted, because his spirit was empowering Jephthah to achieve that victory. But even if the thing we want isn't wrong in and of itself, the means we use to achieve that goal may lead us into sin, which I believe it did for Jephthah. So he successfully defeats the Ammonites. The text says that he dealt a great blow to 20 of their cities and subdued that people group. But, as I mentioned before, the mention of their defeat and victory over the Ammonites is really just almost a footnote in this story. The main focus is on Jephthah's vow here. But with that said, Jephthah is one of the ones mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 of demonstrating faith, along with Gideon, Barak, Samson, and Jephthah, David, and Samuel. So he did demonstrate faith on this occasion, and I think on others as well. So, tragically, upon returning home, who was it that greeted Jephthah first? It was his daughter. And was his daughter one of many children that he had? His only child. The first person to meet him is his only child, a young, nameless daughter. Apparently, she had heard of his success in defeating the Ammonites as she meets him with a tambourine or a hand drum and dances. And so how does Jephthah react to this? Well, ESV says, alas, this is Jephthah speaking, he tore his clothes in verse 35 and says, alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you have become the cause of great trouble for me, for I have opened my mouth to the Lord, and I cannot take back my vow. NET says, Jephthah spoke in this way, oh no, my daughter, you have completely ruined me. You have brought me disaster. Isn't that shocking, the way he reacts, that he pins the blame on his daughter and doesn't, in any way that I can read, accept responsibility for what he has done in making the vow and thinking that he had to fulfill it. The irony here is that his vow leads him to sacrifice the only heir to the inheritance that he had worked so hard to regain. So he effectively disinherited himself. Again, another surprising point in the story is that his daughter agrees with her father, at least at this point, that he must do to her according to the vow that he had made. And to me, it's unclear when his daughter became aware of the terms of the vow. I don't know when that was. It's unlikely that she knew about it at this point, but it seems likely that she found out about it before she makes a request for the 2 months of mourning for her virginity. I'm going to pause there. I think we could talk all night about these verses just because they present me with a lot of questions, and probably you too. But I do want to hear from y'all in terms of what you think. Kyle?
Vow could simply be made out of unfaithfulness. His lack of faithfulness in God, seeing him through these battles, he might have tried to bolster that up in his mind by making an offering to God. Hey, if you get me through this, which he should have already known God was on his side. God had already seen him through all these other things, or going to. And so it could have just been doubt. It could have been simply that he was trying to do everything he could to get through it, maybe because he did selfishly want this seat. I mean, it could have been as simple as that.
Good point. I think that's true. I think, too, unfortunately, that it was his ego and pride and ambition shining through. And I'm not trying to read too much into it, but I can't get over that for 2 months he sat on what he planned to do and still went through with it after that point. I also can't get over the fact that the daughter didn't just run away. But again, don't have an answer to that. But you bring up a good point. You know, his unfaithfulness and lack of trust in the situation shines through. Okay, what else? JD?
This, to me, I think kind of stands out more so as to, it's difficult to know what is, I don't know, it highlights that the narrative in the Old Testament very often doesn't pronounce judgment, condoning or condemning people's actions. It just tells you what happened. And then we have to look at other, like the principle, like you pulled up, various passages that talk about those actions and describe how should we think about those, how should we view them, were they wise or foolish, were they right or wrong? And this one's tricky because he got himself in a situation where he had to break some law. And then it's, I guess, a good reminder for us that sometimes we have some difficult decisions to make to be able to know what is right when we have already done something wrong. How do you correct it in the best way? But this one I think is particularly tricky because of that conflict versus, oh, this person did something wrong, that's obvious, or this person did something right, that's obvious. This one is, yes, it's wrong, but how do you get out of that, or how do you get past it? It's more difficult.
Yeah, my take on it, I'll just take it for what it's worth, is if we got ourselves into a similar situation like Jephthah, the right thing to do would be to take the responsibility on yourself and take whatever punishment comes for that on yourself. So he should have, in my judgment, taken the fall for his vow and not done to his daughter what he had vowed. But obviously that didn't happen, as we'll come to read. So the girl asks her father, as I mentioned before, for 2 months of mourning for her virginity. She wants to, as she says, go up and down on the mountains with her companions. During that period, Jephthah allows this, again, which is a delay of fulfilling his vow. Upon her return, the narrative says Jephthah follows through with his vow, and to my reading, that means he offered up just what his vow said, offered up his only child as a burnt offering. The text says that this event was the beginning of a yearly tradition among Israelite women to mourn for this young girl for 4 days out of the year. Just a side note, if this act that he had done was in some way noble or acceptable in the eyes of the people, why would there have been that tradition following that? Why would there have been this yearly memorial and commemoration of her? And it's interesting, in the book of Judges, which really doesn't spare details in the way of violence, that her end is described in the way that it is. It just says she returned to her father, who did with her according to the vow that he has made. So the narrator of the book spares us as the readers of the horror describing her end. So while not stated in the text, it could be said that Jephthah was willing to do anything to keep his position and status. Again, thinking about how hard he had worked to be in his position that he had come back into. And to J.D.'s point, in no way should this account be understood to imply God's tacit approval of such a heinous act. God never demanded or approved of human sacrifice. We reviewed those verses before. Under the Old Covenant, you know, naturally it's bound to bring up Abraham and Isaac. God did command Abraham to offer up Isaac, but he stopped that sacrifice before it was actually made. And as we mentioned several times before, the Israelites were resoundingly condemned for participating in human sacrifice during this period of the judges. We know that from Psalm 106, 37, and 38. So, while it's true that Jephthah didn't offer his daughter to a Canaanite god like Baal or Molech, it could be said that his daughter was sacrificed to an idol. That would be the idol of Jephthah's ego and ambition. But that, again, that's just my take on it. So, real tricky passages, as J.D. alluded to, not easy to read. And it's one of those things that back in our introductory class, if you can remember back to October, I said that sometimes in the book of Judges, as elsewhere in the Bible, we want that divine commentary to say, you know, God condemned Jephthah for what he did in this instance, and it's lacking. But we can know from understanding God's character and reading other verses in the Bible how he would have viewed such an act. Angel?
I think it shows, you know, God shows us in the Bible a lot of times in instances like these how worldly wisdom ends up getting different characters in trouble because they thought of the world and its allurements instead of following after God and trusting in him, to where we see the consequences of those things. And even in our worldly mind, we can see how tragic it is.
Good point.
Kyle, did you have your hand up too?
I was just going to say, well, I wonder how you would tie your thoughts into the fact that he was deemed as faithful in the end. Mm-hmm. I know through our lens, what he did was, there's all kinds of ways to look at it from our perspective. But in that time frame, everything that was given, he was still in the role of faithfulness. And that is even considering the fact that he did, and I believe he did, he sacrificed his daughter for his vow. So either one, and I'm not implicating God, that God agreed with that or was okay with it. What I'm saying is maybe the fulfillment of the vow, regardless of how hard it was or how tragic his vow was, the fact that he followed through with that vow to God maybe says something, or the other alternative I think has to be is that it was at least a forgivable crime. Mm-hmm. One of those two things have to be true for him to then later show up in this role of faithfulness.
Yeah, that's a good point. Certainly it was forgivable, and I hope that he did.
Yeah.
Was forgiven for it. I would say those verses in Hebrews about faith, to me, are specific in the way that their faith was demonstrated. So in their actions as it related to, in Jephthah's case, taking the charge for, on behalf of Israel, against the Ammonites, he demonstrated faith in being their judge and leader there, but isn't necessarily a blanket statement of, well, he acted in faith in every aspect of his life. Nor do I think it could be said that they all ended their life in a saved state before God. But anyway, that's just my think so on Hebrews 11. What else? Tim?
I thought you have to have a caveat with every word you say about this, but you know that it definitely shows his, you know, nowadays the value of, you know, handshake doesn't mean anything like it used to. A vow to God doesn't mean what it used to some people, but evidently it did to him, and you can see that through his daughter. The fact that she, everything that we can read, said, "This really stinks, but we're going to do this. I'm going to honor that myself with my life." And the fact that he was willing to do that with his only daughter, you know, he may have messed up everything else, but a vow is a vow, and I can't get out of that. I'm going to fulfill what I say to God. And that can teach us a good lesson right there, and make sure that we watch our words, number one, but our word is our word. Our yes is our yes, and our no is our no. And and we better honor that.
I agree. When the vow wouldn't lead us into sin. But if the vow or commitment led us into sin, then we should renege on that vow and choose a different path. But y'all, you know, these are verses that I've been thinking about for months, and I know that y'all have come across them before too, and we're thinking about it again tonight, and they're not easy to reconcile, so I really appreciate y'all's thoughtful comments along these lines. John?
Here. How old was Jephthah when he died?
I don't know.
Not that old, I don't think, from what I read. Maybe, to Kyle's point, maybe this is deemed something forgivable. Maybe it was forgiven. As a parent, would you ever forgive yourself? And he's got about, what, 6, 7, said it, just like those teenagers. He's got about 6 years left, and then he's gone, or so. So that's, I think, something else to consider. How hard did the guilt ride him? Because I think what he's in Hebrews 11 for is because of what he did with the Ammonites, leadership role he took. I have a hard time seeing that harmonizing the murder of your own child for your ego, your pride, your whatever, for your foolishness as something that would qualify as an act of faith.
Agreed.
So we have about half the class left, and I do want to move on, but I'm happy to talk about this with anybody after class or later time. Again, this is just my read-through of it and my impressions, and I'm happy to have your feedback in the event that you disagree or think that I've interpreted the situation incorrectly. So, an event that likely preceded that of the end of chapter 11, where he sacrificed his daughter because of his vow, is this conflict that Jephthah gets into and the Gileadite force gets into with the Ephraimites. And so, you remember that the Ephraimites were easily offended, apparently. They had previously gotten upset because Gideon hadn't asked them to battle when they were going up against the Midianites. And now, Ephraimites are in a tizzy because they hadn't been asked to fight against the Ammonites. And so they meet here in Zaphon. And Jephthah's story is not over. The Ephraimite men are called to arms. They travel to Zaphon, which means north, to confront Jephthah. They question why they weren't asked to join in battle against the Ammonites, and they threaten Jephthah. They threaten to burn his house down with him and probably his relatives inside. So this episode, I said, likely follows the defeat of the Ammonites in the previous chapter and precedes the tragic events of chapter 11 with his daughter. Jephthah responds by saying that he had asked the Ephraimites to aid in the Gileadites, Jephthah's crew, in battle against the Ammonites. So let's keep all these groups straight. But they didn't save him from their hand. Whether that actually happened, we don't know, because that invitation is not recorded for us in the narrative. So when Jephthah says in verse 3, I saw that you would not save me, speaking to the Ephraimites, I took my life in my hand and crossed over against the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me? So this attempt at diplomacy is also unsuccessful, and this is with his own countrymen. So the Ephraimites further insult Jephthah and his crew in verse 4 by saying, you are fugitives of Ephraim, you Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and Manasseh. So basically implying that they were refugees squatting on Ephraim and Manasseh's land. So with this, the Gileadites capture the fords of the Jordan, which again, the Gileadites are Jephthah's forces, and with any Ephraimite forces attempting to cross back over, they set up a test. Those wishing to cross back over were asked, are you Ephraimites? And if they said no, they were asked to pronounce a word shibboleth, which either means a flowing stream or an ear of grain. However, could the Ephraimites pronounce that word correctly? They couldn't. And so that was a tell that they were actually Ephraimites. And so then, based on that, they were executed. And all that were defeated here were 42,000 Ephraimites, according to the narrative. So this is not Israel fighting against foreigners like the Ammonites, as they had previously done, but infighting within Israel. And it speaks to the further deterioration of the national character and climate. Remember, Judges is a book where the people are spiraling down into further and further sin, and this is perhaps as low as it gets as far as the chronological narrative goes. So as John mentioned, Jephthah ends up judging Israel 6 years. He died and was buried in a city in Gilead. So that's the end of Jephthah's story. I'll pause here before we get into these three brief judges quickly, see if anybody has any question or comment.
First time Ephraim's gotten on a tiff about not being invited to the party. In chapter 8, the men of Ephraim said to, this is Gideon, "What is this thing you've done to us, not calling us when you went to fight against Midian?" So they're really keen on being able to participate in the fighting, but that time he's able to talk them down. Not so here.
Yes, that's right. And sadly, he resorted to this, what amounts to essentially a civil war here. Okay, what else? All right. At the end of chapter 11, in quick succession, three judges are mentioned. And so we've had these brief interludes between some of the major stories of the judges. So between the accounts of Ehud and Deborah, there was a brief account of Shamgar, and then between the story of Gideon and Jephthah, which we just finished, we had talked about Tola and Jer. So now we're going to read about three. Ibzan of Bethlehem is the next judge introduced in the narrative. He judged Israel for 7 years and had 60 children, 30 sons and 30 daughters. After his death, he was buried in Bethlehem. And by the way, doesn't that just stand in sharp relief, the Holy Spirit to the author of Judges mentioning here how many children Ibzan had after the account of Jephthah having no heir and no children? So then we talk about Elon, who was a Zebulunite. The next judge mentioned he ruled for 10 years. After his tenure, Elon died and was buried in Ajalon. And then lastly, there's Abdon, last judge listed in this section in chapter 11. He's called the son of Hillel and part of the Ephraimite tribe, and also had an extensive family, 40 sons and 30 grandsons. It's also talked about how they rode on 70 donkeys. So remember, that was just a sign of status and wealth, and also that the donkeys were well-suited to the kind of battle that they were likely engaged in. He ruled for 8 years. He died and was buried in the land of Ephraim. That brings us to the end of chapter 11, but if you're longing for more information about the minor judges, then I recommend a great lesson back from June, where David talked about all the minor judges. So if you feel like you haven't gotten enough tonight, there's 30 extra minutes for you there back from June. With that then, we'll move on into our last chapter, but I'll see if anybody has a comment or question before we go on. All right. Yes. Sorry. Wyatt.
Verses 5 and 6, I do think it's interesting what test Jephthah puts in front of the Ephraimites that he knows that they won't be able to pass. That they had that speech impediment where shh would not come out correctly.
Right, yeah. That's true. And that word, shibboleth, I didn't mention this, but I'll mention it briefly, is actually retained in modern English. So we still have that phrase in our dictionary, and it means just like this. So a word that a certain group or people pronounce, or a phrase that's known only to a certain group that you can use to distinguish those people. So I thought that I would put the city Refugio on a slide and just ask, how would you pronounce this city's name, and then find out whoever would say Refugio, and then we would know, okay, that person's not from Texas. Figured out pretty quickly. So we've now made it to our last judge in our study, probably the most infamous, and that's Samson. So four of the chapters in Judges, which is about 20%, are used by the Holy Spirit to tell Samson's story. This first chapter, though, verse chapter 13, describes the beginning of his life, mainly focuses on his parents. And as we go through, I want you to note the character of his parents in this story, and the hope that they must have had for their son, who, according to the angel, the messenger from God, said, shall begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines. Timeline-wise, Samson is likely at the end of the period that's described by the book of Judges, and that's about 50 years before King Saul became king. It's about the end, beginning of the 11th century BC. And rather than leading an army, like so many of the judges have before, Samson was a one-man show. He went out and battled the Philistines single-handedly. We briefly read about the Philistines before, back with Shamgar, at the end of chapter 3, and even at the beginning of this section in chapter 10, understood that the Philistines, in addition to the Ammonites, were the ones oppressing Israel at this time. And is the Philistine threat going to go away when the book of Judges ends? Or are they still going to be a problem? Yeah. So who's the most infamous Philistine in the Bible? Who's that? Goliath. Yeah. So Goliath, David, Saul, all that's going to come after the time of the Judges. So the Philistines continue to be enemies of God's people even after they have a king. So here in chapter 13, the tragic cycle of Judges repeats itself again. God hands the Israelites over to the Philistines for oppression, and this lasts for 40 years. Now we're introduced to Samson's parents, and they're of the tribe of Dan, living in Zorah. So this is Dan, and then this is the Sorek Valley. This is Timnah, and most of what we're going to read about Samson's activity are going to take place just within this map, so you'll probably be seeing it a few times. So his father's name is Manoah, which means rest. His wife, who really, I think, is the admirable one of the story here, is nameless, but at the beginning, we're told she's barren and childless. The angel of the Lord, who we talked about before, appears to Manoah's wife, tells her that she will give birth to a son, and he gives her specific instructions on what she needed to do while she was pregnant with that child, and then once that child was born, what he needed to do. She tells him in verse 5, look, you will conceive and have a son. You must never cut his hair, for the child will be dedicated to God or a Nazarite from birth. He will begin to deliver Israel from the power of the Philistines. So we don't have a lot of time tonight to delve into it too deeply, but you may remember that the Nazarite vow is described in Numbers chapter 6. We understand that it was to be a voluntary vow, that it was for a limited time, and that it involved three provisions. First of all, abstinence from wine, strong drink, or anything associated with the vine, that there was to be no cutting of the hair. And finally, do you remember the third one? Wyatt? Yeah, no contact with the dead. So this is interesting as it relates to Samson because he's being put into this position before he has a choice. It's while he's still in utero or in the womb is when he's set apart to God. And for that reason, I'm not sure that Samson meets the criteria of being in the Nazarite vow because it's not something that he himself took. But Samson's parents are told, at least his mom initially is told, he's going to be set apart for service to the Lord. So Manoah's wife, upon hearing this message from the angel, reports back to her husband most of what the messenger told her. However, she leaves out one part. She left out the fact that her son or their son was going to start saving Israel from the hand of the Philistines, which likely explains Manoah's later request from the angel to explain Samson's way of life. He says, how should we bring him up and what will be his way of life? Well, he didn't have one important fact that the angel had communicated to his wife, and that was that Samson would lead an effort to begin Israel's offense against the Philistines. So upon hearing this, Manoah prays to God and asks for this man of God to return and teach them what they are to do with the child. Says in the chapter, God listened to the voice of Manoah, sends an angel again, but on this occasion, the angel appears to Manoah's wife, not to both of them. So she runs to tell Manoah the messenger has returned. They approach the angel, whom they think is a man. Manoah confirms with him he's the same one who had previously appeared to his wife, and it's on this instance that Manoah asks what the child's manner of life would be, as well as his mission. So in response, does the angel give any new information to Manoah and his wife? No. He essentially says, your wife needs to be very attentive to what I told her before. Strict adherence to the previous directions that had been given. Now this brings us to verse 15. I know I'm kind of breezing through these verses. And if we don't get through all of it, that's fine. But if you have a comment or question at this point, I'd love to hear it before we go on. All right, so in verse 15, Manoah asks for the angel to stay and to be their guest for a meal. So this is ancient hospitality, as one writer put it, a rite of passage in which the status of stranger is transformed into that of an intimate guest. The angel agrees to stay, but he says he would not eat the food. But if they wanted to prepare a meal, it would be accepted as a burnt and grain offering. And does this bring to anyone's mind a previous instance in Judges where a similar scene unfolded? Yes, that's right, Gideon. So Gideon also had prepared food for the angel, and the angel was the one that touched the food with a stick, and then it caught on fire. And Gideon reacted very similarly to how Manoah and his wife are going to react. So there's this little bit of back and forth with Manoah asking for the angel's name. And in the ESV, the angel responds in this way: "Why do you ask me my name, seeing it is wonderful?" And the NET translates his response in this way, not as a question, but as a statement: "You should not ask me my name because you cannot comprehend it." So that word, incomprehensible or wonderful, refers to what is in a category of its own and is beyond full human understanding. And interestingly, when Manoah asked for his name, the angel's name, in the Hebrew, it literally says, "Who your name?" As if Manoah stumbles over his words and originally intended to ask, "Who are you?" and then changed it to, "What is your name?" So Manoah is a little bit bumbling here. The angel again responds by saying, "You should not ask me my name because you cannot comprehend it." So Manoah offers the young goat to the Lord, and as the flame went up from the offering, the angel went up in the flame of the altar with it. So they're, of course, flabbergasted by this, even fearful, according to verse 22, falling to the ground. And so it's at this point they realize whom the messenger was, not just a man or a prophet, but an angel. They're afraid. They said, "We surely shall die, for we have seen God." That's Manoah speaking. How does his wife respond? Is she also hysterical? Yeah, that's, in summary, exactly what she said. If God wanted to kill us, he would have already done it. So, a very quick takeaway. We can also help others who are in situations like Manoah was, just overwrought or overcome by fear or emotion, by appealing to reason and facts. But I will say, wisdom and judgment should be used in deciding if that approach is appropriate. Sometimes, if someone's in a state like Manoah is, just emotional and fearful, the best thing we can do for that individual is be like Job's friends were at first, where they just sat with him and their presence consoled him, but their input was not necessary at that moment. So the angel's message comes true. Manoah and his wife have a son. Modern-day picture, here's Zora, where they're from. That's the Philistine plain. So you can see that the Philistines, who were ruling over the Israelites in this part of Israel at this time, were just right on their doorstep. There's Zora. They have a son, name him Samson, which his name means sun-like or solar. The text says that God blessed Samson and that the Spirit began to stir him or move him to action. So here in chapter 13, we have a hopeful and promising beginning, I think, to what ends up being a tragic life. And Samson's life leaves us with many questions. One of those being, how much does the character of the leader reflect the character of the people that they're leading? But I'll just leave that for you to ponder on. I think we have like a minute left. So with that, I'll just briefly leave us with our takeaway for tonight. Appreciate y'all's attention as we've kind of breezed through this last chapter here. And it's going back to Jephthah. Hope we can all agree that he was exceedingly foolish in the vow that he made. And he made a terrible situation even worse by trying to pin the blame on his daughter. That was just his gut reaction, was to put it back on his daughter, which is a terrible way to react. We can also create messes in our lives when we fail to guard our hearts and especially control our speech. We know that our speech is just evidence of what's in our hearts. We have to be people of integrity. Our yes means yes and our no means no. And always remember that what we say, we'll give an account for on the judgment day. So that brings us to the end of our class tonight. Thank you all for your attention.